Okay, so for those of you who don't know me, my name is Jim Fuller. I work with Dong Lai at Cornell, and I'm a graduate fellow here at KOTP for this semester. I will also be talking about KOI-54, and I think you'll find it's a very interesting system. Josh covered most of the details for me. One thing I do want to talk about a little bit is the visibility of the modes. Like Josh said, it's sensitive to the inclination of the star's spin axis relative to our line of sight. So an M equals zero mode is going to pulse if we view it face on, which is roughly how we're viewing it in KOI-54. That's kind of what it would look like, and so you're going to see a brightness variation. But an M equals two mode, or sorry, this is also M equals zero viewed edge on. An M equals two mode viewed face on is just going to look like a rotational, it's just going to look like a rugby ball rotating. And so you're not going to see any flux variation coming from it. Whereas if it was a two-dimensional star, it would look something like that if it was edge on. And so there we'd expect to see very large luminosity variations. I want to say the inclination of the star's spin axis in KOI-54 is not known. It's likely close to the orbital inclination, which is like 5.5 degrees. But the star's spin axis could be offset by a few degrees, and that can actually have big implications for the visibility of the mode. So you have to be careful with that. It also has big implications for the spin rates of the stars as observed from VSin-I. So it would be good to get that nailed down. Okay. All right. The other question I want to address for most of my talk is why the two dominant modes in this system have frequencies of 90 and 91 times the orbital frequency. It seems a very odd number for the system to pick, and it's not very well explained by the M equals zero modes that explain most of the other observed oscillations. Okay. To approach this problem, we first want to think about what is the probability of seeing a mode near resonance. And so up here, a mode that's near resonance is going to have a frequency that's almost an integer multiple of the orbital frequency, but it's going to be offset by some detuning epsilon, which is some small number. Okay, so the modes, the natural modes of the star are going to have just some kind of random frequencies, and they may or may not be near a harmonic of the orbital frequency. And so the chances of a mode to be near resonance is just twice times epsilon. So if we want to see a mode that's in 1/10, that's very close to resonance, its frequency is within 1/10 of an orbital harmonic, the chances are just about 1 out of 5. Okay, and so most of the M equals zero modes, they need to have a detuning of something like 1/10. And so about 1 out of every 5 of those modes happens to just naturally be close to resonance. And so about 1 out of 5 of those M equals zero modes are visible. And that's what we see in the system, and that's why some of the M equals zero modes are very visible. And some of them, you just don't see at all. Now the situation gets a little bit more complicated if we're considering modes that are very near resonance. Because if a mode is very near resonance, if epsilon is almost exactly zero, then the mode will be at a very large amplitude, and so it will be dissipating energy very quickly. That means it's going to be sucking energy out of the orbit and dissipating it as heat in the star. That changes the orbital frequency, and it causes the system to move through resonance very rapidly, such that the probability of seeing a mode very near resonance goes as epsilon cubed. Now, for these dominant oscillations, we know we need epsilon somewhere around 1/100. So the probability of seeing a mode that close to resonance is like less than 1 in 1,000. But we've got two of them. We have about 50 modes to choose from or so in KOI-54. But it still doesn't make sense that we should see two modes so near resonance. So you need an explanation for why these modes are so near resonance. And that's where I bring in this idea of resonance locking. And this is a way to keep a mode very near resonance for a long period of time so that it's very likely to see one of these resonant modes in the system, like KOI-54. So To understand this mechanism, remember that both the orbital and the mode frequencies are changing as the orbit evolves in time. The mode frequency is changing because the spin of the star is changing. So because m equals 2 modes have this Doppler shift due to the spin of the star, their frequency in the inertial frame is changing as the star's spin rate changes. And also the orbital frequency is changing because modes are taking energy out of the orbit and then damping in the star. So the orbit is slowly shrinking. The orbital frequency is gradually increasing. Now, at resonance, a mode just has an integer. Its frequency is just an integer multiple of the orbital frequency. And it can stay in that resonance if somehow that integer doesn't change in time. Okay? Now, I just want to remind you, resonance locking is observed in other types of astrophysical systems, such as the moons of Jupiter. They're in this 1 to 2 to 4 orbital resonance. So that's an example of how resonance locking can happen in other systems. But I also want to emphasize that the resonance locking mechanism for KOI-54 is quite different from this, even though tidal effects are involved in both cases. Okay, so more about resonance locking. It turns out that there is basically a critical mode for which its ratio of energy to angular momentum is just right, so that when it gets excited and decays, it spins up the star at just the right rate, such that the mode frequency divided by the orbital frequency stays constant. And it turns out that that critical mode has a frequency of nc, which is given by this expression, which is basically just the orbital angular, the orbital moment of inertia divided by the moment of inertia of the star, the 1/2 power. And for KOI-54, that's something like 135. So we might expect, first glance, we might expect a mode somewhere near 135 to be resonantly locked. But this number doesn't have to be an integer. In fact, in general, it's not an integer. And so in general, resonance locking, you wouldn't expect it to occur if this was the only thing going on. But there's other things affecting the orbital properties of the system and the spin rates of the star. In particular, the stars can change their spin due to magnetic braking. These stars, it turns out, are just starting to evolve off the main sequence, so they're starting to expand and spin down. So that's another thing that can change the spin of the star. And it turns out that if you add some spin down to the star, what you find is that any mode with frequency less than this critical value could lock into resonance, in theory. Okay, so we should expect some modes less than 135 to lock into resonance. So to test this, we do some numerical calculations. We self-consistently evolve the orbital parameters and the mode parameters in time. So we watch how the modes are excited, what their energies are, and how fast they damp, and so how fast the orbit and spin of the system change. And so here's a sample calculation. What I have plotted here are the energies of three different modes. Those are the black solid lines. And you'll see that essentially immediately after my calculation started, this mode jumped up to a high value of energy, about 1,000 times its normal energy, and stayed in that resonance for, in this calculation, like 100 million years. So a very long time. I didn't have to fine-tune any parameters. The modes naturally will lock into resonance when you do these calculations. You'll see its resonance locking is actually ended when this other mode locks into resonance. And it turns out this other mode has a higher frequency and tends to dominate the orbital energetics of the system. So what we're going to expect to see, actually, the mode that we would expect to see locked into resonance is going to be the mode with the highest frequency, but with frequency less than that critical value of n that I showed earlier. Down at the bottom is a boring mode that doesn't lock into resonance, just for reference. And finally, the red dashed line is an m equals 0 mode that I've also plotted. You can see it passes through resonances but doesn't lock, except right here you'll notice it passes through a resonance and kicks this mode out of resonance. So that's another thing that can happen, is interactions between modes. Well, it's not really between the modes themselves, but interactions between their effects on the orbital parameters of the system can cause modes to lock in and out of resonance. Okay. You also see, I don't want to say much here, except that the spin frequency of the star and the orbital frequency increase fairly rapidly when a mode is locked in resonance, which is basically this whole time. And they change less slowly when a mode is not locked. They change less quickly when a mode is not locked into resonance. Okay. So earlier I said the critical value of n should be about 135, but that was only taking into account tidal effects in one star. In KY54, there are two stars. They're essentially identical. They're almost identical. So we might expect tidal dissipation to be roughly identical in each star. And if that's the case, then that critical value of n drops by a factor of square root of 2, because now there's energy dissipation occurring in both stars. The orbit is shrinking faster. And so that drops the critical value of n to about 95, which is just above 90 and 91. So the explanation here is that the 90 and 91 oscillation modes are m equals 2 modes that are locked into resonance, one in each star. So this theory explains why 90 and 91 are observed, why modes of higher frequency are not observed. And so that's a good start. We didn't really have an explanation with m equals 0 modes. It was kind of hard to explain these big oscillations. But I think this resonance locking can explain these largest observed oscillations. Here's just another numerical calculation showing that resonance locking can occur when you include tidal dissipation in both stars simultaneously. It also happens to be that when you include tidal dissipation in both stars, the resonance locking events tend to be deeper. You fall deeper into resonance. And so the energies of the modes are correspondingly higher. And that results in more rapid orbital decay and more rapid spin up of the star, as you can see in this plot. Eventually, the mode falls out of resonance because its value of n approaches the critical value of n, which is this solid line. And then it gets very easy for that mode to get kicked out of resonance due to a resonance with another mode. Okay. The last thing I was going to talk about was the nonlinear mode coupling in the star. Like Josh said, there are modes that are not integer multiples of the orbital frequency. And very interestingly, two of those modes, their frequencies add up exactly to one of the largest modes that's observed, which we might expect. Also, if the n equals 90 and 91 modes are indeed m equals 2 modes, that implies they have very large amplitudes. And so that's going to bring them closer to this threshold of nonlinearity. So that kind of also adds up with this picture of these being m equals 2 modes, because that would explain why they are nonlinear and create these daughter modes. Okay, so future prospects for systems like this. We would like to identify these modes using spectral techniques or multicolor photometry. We are just kind of guessing what the modes are right now. It would be nice to get some confirmation. We'd also like to find more of these systems. Lars tells me there's like 15 or 17 more or something, systems similar to KOI-54 that have these tidally induced pulsations. That would be very cool to see those systems and learn more about tidal astroseismology from them. And finally, if the modes are really resonantly locked, that, like I said, it implies a fairly fast orbital decay rate, which may be able to be measured because we have a lot of very accurate timing tools we can use with this system, because the modes have very well measured frequencies. If we measure how those frequencies change in time and how the orbital frequency changes in time, we can get an estimate of the orbital decay rate of the system, which would be very cool. And yeah, finally, find more of these systems and see what we can learn about the stars from the modes themselves. That's everything. Thank you.
Questions?
This is exciting work. Thank you very much. I have a question. How does your resonance locking compare with that described by Vite and Savonai, which involves a prograde and a retrograde mode?
Yeah, so I developed this idea of resonance locking only to find out that Vite and Savonage have already kind of figured it out. It's basically the same idea as their paper, but like one of the things they say actually in their paper is that there's a lot of different things that can change the intrinsic frequencies of the modes in the star. So you can have stellar spin down, stellar evolution changes the intrinsic frequencies. Another thing that you can have is you can have opposing modes, like you said. So one mode is trying to spin the star down, one is trying to spin it up. There's a lot of different mechanisms you can invoke that help make sure that the resonance locking happens.
So there seems to be a bit of a debate between you and Josh in terms of the M value of the mode.
Yeah.
You're claiming the M equals positive 2, and Josh is saying it's M equals 0, is that right? And from my understanding, the M equals 0 mode doesn't carry any momentum in the sense that cannot get resonantly locked because the spin of the star will not change.
Right.
When you excite that mode, it just damp energy into the star but not changing the spin. So therefore, you cannot get resonance locking.
With an M equals 0 mode, right.
Is that right? So in that, can you, maybe Josh can comment on it. Would that exclude M equals 0 as a solution, or?
It makes it more difficult. It makes it hard to explain why these would be M equals 0 modes. Maybe Josh has more to say.
I'm assuming so.
So it is possible to get M equals 0 resonance locking. It's a slightly different argument, but that would not be consistent with, you wouldn't be able to explain these modes with that. The reason that I'm not too enthusiastic about the explanation is, so we've done similar simulations of orbital evolution, and if you simultaneously include both stars, what we found is that you sort of leapfrog over resonance lock. So you'll have a resonance lock in one star, and then you'll get a resonance lock in the other star later. And I never see two at the same time, simultaneously including both. So I don't know if you have a comment on that.
Yeah, so I did get resonance locking both stars at the same time. One of the things that can affect it, though, is the spin rate, because that's affecting which values of little n, so whether it's the 14th G mode or the 20th mode, that is affected by the stellar spin rate. So depending on what spin rate you include in your calculations can have an effect on whether or not the modes are able to lock into resonance.
I found it regardless of the initial conditions.
Okay, well, we should talk more.
Okay. Oh, can I ask one question?
Yeah.
So I just remember from your paper, so can you go back to the 95? Sorry. Okay, yep. All right. So I thought that I remembered, and maybe I'm misremembering from your paper, that you showed that if you include both stars, the critical harmonic, I thought it went down to like 60 or something like that.
Yeah, so in the first version of the paper I released on Archive, it went down to like 85 or 80 or something, and that's because I had calculated the moment of inertia of the stars wrong, which was pretty embarrassing. And then I redid the calculation, realized I had calculated that wrong, and luckily it helped our theory when I found the right value, because it bumped this value up above 90.
So now you think it's right.
Hopefully. I was very glad to find that mistake.
I merely reported to you and others, Jim, that Kurtz had announced verbally that there were 15 or 17 more of these stars in Kepler for which I haven't seen any data. But I would say it's an extremely fantastic opportunity for both of you to make predictions, because they haven't shown anything yet. And those systems should not all be face-on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both of you have very different predictions for that, as well as the sort of quantitative things here. So I think making that distinction clear so that the observers actually can dive in and hopefully publish the papers. I don't know what's going on with them, but... Yeah, but you know, the only one being face-on, of course, was quite alarming to all of us, so I'm happy to hear that they have 15 to 17 more which are not face-on.
And face on. Jocelyn is going to twist our arm and try and convince us to eat some of this breakfast. So we come back for 11.